I'd say by and large, real estate entrepreneurs hate the capital raising side of the equation.
Welcome to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals who work with investors, buyers, and sellers of commercial real estate coast to coast. Whether you're an investor, broker, lender, property manager, attorney, or accountant, we're here to learn from the experts.
Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio. This is episode number 71. Weekly, we share interviews with real estate experts passing on their experience and knowledge. Thanks for joining us this week. My name is J. Darren Gross. We're so glad you're here. We are always on the lookout for information that can help you move your real estate investing to the next level. In just a minute, we're going to speak with Matt Burke. Matt is the CEO of Fairway America and SBREfunds.com. They provide advisory and administrative services to real estate investment funds. In the interview, we talk about the challenges of managing a fund and what's required to be successful. If you are a returning listener, we would like to welcome you back. And if this is your first time checking out Commercial Real Estate Pro Network podcast, thanks for checking us out. If you like what we're doing, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. There's a couple of easy ways you can do that. You can either go to the website commercialrealestateprodnetwork.com. It's all spelled out. And on the homepage, there's a link that says podcast. Go ahead and click that. And when you come to the podcast page, there's a subscribe button there. You can click that and it'll lead you to iTunes or Stitcher. We're on both. Or if you're already a user of iTunes or Stitcher, go to your account, go ahead and type in Commercial Real Estate Pro Network in the search bar. And when our logo pops up, it's the headphones with CREPN between the ears. Go ahead and click subscribe and you're done. And that way you'll be sure to catch all of our episodes. And I say that because we're noodling with a couple of ideas about a couple of additional episodes. Not exactly certain on how to promote those or to distribute them. And so I'm thinking right now we just make those available to subscribers. But there's a couple of different topics that we're zeroing in on. The one would be just first deals, where we specifically interview in a shorter format guests about their first real estate deal. And then another possibility also we're looking at is insurance claims. Again, shorter format, but just kind of some bullet point and more in-depth analysis. We'll get like some claims adjusters and tell some horror stories and how coverage works. But anyway, if you're interested, make sure you're subscribed. That way you'll get those. Also, I want to invite you, if we are not yet connected and you're on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn, be sure to reach out and connect with me. If you're working on a deal and you want to talk about it, or if there's some insurance questions you have, please reach out to me. My contact information is on the website, commercialrealestateprodnetwork.com. Go ahead and click the contact button and you'll find my information there. The email is darren@jdarrengross.com, and also my phone number is there too if you'd like to give me a call. Either way, like I said, if you've got something you'd like to talk about, whether it's a real estate deal or if there's an insurance question you've got, I will do all I can to help you. I promise you that. And lastly, before we get on with the show, if you are on LinkedIn, be sure to check out our group. It's called Commercial Real Estate Pro Network, and it's a great place to network with commercial real estate professionals. So please consider joining the group. All right, let's get on with the show. My guest today is an entrepreneur. He's an avid cyclist. He's a husband, father, and the CEO of Fairway America and SBREfunds.com, and an author. Matt Burke is my guest. Matt, how are you doing?
Good, Darren. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for doing this. I'm looking forward to our conversation today. But before we get going, if you could do me a favor and give the listeners a little kind of fill in a little bit of the details on your path to Fairway America.
Sure. Well, I started Fairway in the early 1990s, so I've had it for almost 25 years. Hard to believe, but. Wow. been a private lender for a long time, run a number of private, what I call small balance real estate pooled investment funds. We're on our seventh fund, did our first one back in about 2000. We provide advisory and consulting services to other small balance real estate entrepreneurs around the country to help them set up their own pooled investment fund. We do back-end fund administration for them, and then in our funds we invest in and alongside them, and you know, some of the ones that we like the best on the strategies that, they might have. So really our mission is to help drive capital to a lot of the kind of best-in-class real estate asset-based entrepreneurs around the country.
And for our listeners, I know real estate investing kind of runs the gamut as far as different opportunities. I mean, some people think of flips, some people think of single family, multifamily, and commercial, directly or passively, maybe through syndication, notes, and funds. You, in your structure, you guys primarily, is there one of these that you stay away from, or do the opportunities based on the funds venture into all of those?
I'm very familiar with all of those different types that you rattled off and more. I think I would categorize us as somewhat agnostic to the strategy. I think we're very opportunistic in terms of, first and foremost, trying to find what I would consider to be the best operators. You know, call them sponsors or entrepreneurs or operators or whatever you want. But the people who have a particular strategy in whatever geographic territory they're operating in and have done it and can demonstrate that they have integrity and that they know what they're doing, they're competent and capable, and they produce attractive returns, those are the ones that will really dive in and try to help improve their capital structure, set up funds, administer funds, and invest in alongside them. And it can be, you know, I have a lot of clients that are fix and flip, you know, people that just acquire property and do it on a big scale. You know, down to the people that just do a handful of them. We have people that lend to those kinds of people, so they're lenders to flippers. We've got value add multifamily guys, retail, office, industrial, self storage, kind of you name it. And people doing value add where they're buying an underperforming or undermanaged property, and you know, with the intent to acquire it and improve its operations or its condition or both, and add value to that property, and then you know, manage it or own it for a period of time and turn around and sell it. Got guys that buy distressed notes that are at discounts from, you know, banks or servicers or other parties, and you know, make a living out of that. Got guys that do tax lien certificates. You know, anything that fundamentally has real estate at its core in terms of, you know, underlying the investment opportunity is something that we would consider opportunistically, primarily focusing first and foremost on, you know, the operator and then the asset level details.
So you guys have essentially, and this is kind of my simplification of it, but is it fair to say you have two kind of streams of customers, one being the investor that's looking to invest into a fund, and then the other being one that's trying to raise capital for a fund?
Yes. I mean, simplifying it down to that level is it's a dual-sided platform, right? On the one hand, you have the real estate entrepreneurs who are generating the deals that produce the returns that have an appetite for capital to do those deals. I mean, real estate's a very capital-intensive business. And then on the other hand, you have investors who are looking to place money and generate a return who don't have the ability to go directly do the deals themselves. And, you know, do it through all these other parties. And there's a variety of ways in which we engage both of those constituencies. And, you know, specifically on the investor side, they can invest in our fund and then, you know, give us the discretion to pick and choose the underlying assets. Or they can also, you know, the platform we've created, I've got entrepreneurs all over the country that have all manner of strategies, as I just described, and investors can invest in one or more of the underlying managers or strategies if, you know, they prefer to go that route or both.
So the ones that are coming to you to create a fund, is there any kind of a picture that you can draw or a description of somebody that has? What's the level of experience or the number of deals or kind of their background that makes sense for somebody to get to that point?
Well, you know, again, as to strategy, they can come from any one of a number of verticals, right? They could be lenders. Maybe they're running a private lending shop, and they have, and they've got an origination platform, loan officers and underwriters, and, you know, they're brokering loans. They might have a servicing platform where they collect the loans on behalf of their investors and then pass through the interest, and typically those people will do that one investment at a time. So each loan they make secured by an individual property is placed with a single investor, or in some cases several investors, in that one deal. You know, they typically will reach the point where their platform is now grown and they have an appetite, you know, or capacity to take more capital than they can handle doing it one deal at a time, which is very inefficient, and they want to then try to do it in a more capital efficient manner, and that's when they want to make the leap to putting it into a pooled investment fund, which the definition of that is you have multiple investors and multiple assets inside the same vehicle, which is an order of magnitude more sophisticated. And, you know, it's challenging to make that leap, and that's really what we help them do. You know, I'd say we've set up 100 and some odd funds in the last several years, and, you know, everything from, you know, one-man bands to people with, you know, companies doing $10, $20, $50 million in revenue in some strategy or another, and kind of everything in between. I'd say the ones that are much more likely to be successful are organizations that at least have some, you know, depth of history, you know, management team, a staff, a platform, you know, at least 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 people, you know, doing those deals. They have some regular level of deal volume that you know necessitates that capital, and they're not just hoping that they're going to go set up a fund and then go find some deals, because that really doesn't work very well. So, you know, the guy who's going out and trying to flip his first house, I mean, there's absolutely no reason for that person to even, you know, consider a fund. The guy who's flipped, you know, 100 houses in the last 3 or 4 years, you know, is probably a much better candidate.
You mentioned the and all of the kind of the attributes of a successful operator that you know gets a fund going. But is there one single point that you can commonly refer to that maybe that they hadn't foreseen as far as a challenge? I mean, like you said, when you're starting off and you're pointing to a specific property and you have a specific you know, the funds and the property all match up, but now all of a sudden you've got a fund and you have more opportunity, more funds. Is there a single challenge that you can point to that, or a common challenge that new funds face?
I mean, there's lots of them. So, you know, if I pick some of the top ones, I would say people underestimate the challenge or the difficulty of raising capital in a discretionary fund format. Because, you know, the word discretion means that when the investor puts money into that fund, they are appointing the manager, you know, the, you know, arbiter of the deals that they're going to do, and the investor no longer has any say in which deals get chosen and which ones they don't. So, you know, they're abdicating full responsibility to that manager to make those decisions on their behalf without any ability to, you know, have any input or influence in that, you know, going in. So that's a, you know, the level of trust and confidence that the investor has to have in that manager in order to, you know, take that kind of risk is just much, much greater than in a single individual deal. And I think people underestimate, you know, the impact of that. There are a lot of other issues in terms of, you know, how you value the shares, to, you know, how you report to those investors, given that, you know, it's a non-publicly traded, non, you know, valued asset that is being determined by the manager, who has widely varying degrees of operational capacity to, you know, deliver reporting and timely communications to those investors. And, you know, it's hard. Running a fund is not easy, and it's not for the faint of heart, and it's not for people that aren't, you know, talented entrepreneurs that, you know, have the capacity to work hard and make things happen. So, There's, I mean, so the answer is there's no one thing. There's a lot of things that, that make it, you know, challenging.
And is that part of what you guys at Fairway help the fund?
Oh, of course.
Funds with?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we prepare them for what they're getting themselves into. You know, help them set up the structure in the most, you know, at least to the best of our ability, in a way that matches whatever their underlying asset model is as close as possible, and creates a fee structure that is fair to both the manager and the investor. And you know, we help them set up a turnkey fund. We, part of that is connecting them with legal counsel who signs off on all those securities documents, because of course in a fund you are issuing securities, and you know, you're playing squarely in the securities world, and that's a different world, highly regulated, even though these are the funds that we help people with are called 506 Regulation D funds. They're exempt from registration with the SEC. You have to notify the SEC that you're setting them up, but you don't have to go get approved or anything. You just file a notice. But that said, you're still issuing securities, and you still have to play by all the rules of doing that. And you know, the legal component of it, which is done by outside securities counsel, helps them through all of that. And we provide practical business experience from the trenches around what they can expect with respect to, you know, matching their assets to their investor base, to the administration, to the reporting, to the operations, and all the myriad component parts that go into, you know, running a fund successfully. And we help them navigate all that.
So not a do-it-yourself kind of a opportunity there. The level of scrutiny and reporting and all that, I can't even imagine. What you mentioned the, raising capital and the discretion. Is there anything that you can point to that really characterizes a successful fund? I mean, because let's say everybody's got you've got two funds and they both have raised the capital. Is there any kind of a characteristic you can point to where you see, funds that are successful that perform better as opposed to ones that maybe struggle?
Well, from a performance standpoint, I'd say the ones that perform the best are the guys that, you know, people that have the most discipline when it comes to underwriting good deals. I mean, there can certainly be a temptation for managers, if they are successful in raising capital, to just put the money out into whatever they can get their hands on, you know, to make money. And that's certainly a danger that investors have to watch out for, is that they're not dealing with someone who's going to just get greedy and put money into bad deals because they're going to get paid. So the people with the best discipline around, you know, only buying and acquiring assets that meet, you know, stringent underwriting criteria are the ones that will perform from an asset standpoint the best. But even people that have those characteristics can struggle to raise capital because it's just hard. I mean, you know, it's a lot of effort and a lot of work. I'd say by and large, real estate entrepreneurs hate the capital raising side of the equation. I mean, that's not what they like to do. They're real estate people. They like to go out and kick dirt and negotiate deals and, you know, find tenants and buy houses and fix them up and sell them. And, you know, but going out and dealing with investors to raise the capital is the part that they just don't like and they're not particularly good at. So I'd say that is by far the harder side of the equation. I think people underestimate and misunderstand what goes into successfully raising capital, because it's not just being a charismatic person. It's not just throwing an ad out there. It's not just attending a conference or whatever things people do to raise capital. It's a combination of a whole bunch of different elements, including, you know, how you communicate with those people, how you report to them, being able to deliver information in a timely, accurate, meaningful way. So I'd say the people that are successful raising capital, A, they could do good deals, and B, they take seriously the capital raising side of their business and don't just, you know, pray and hope that and try to find somebody else to do it for them, you know, when just because they don't like it. So they accept the fact that it's an integral part of their business and it's necessary to success, and they devote the resources and the time necessary to cultivating that component of their business. And that's a minority of people. And, you know, and to that end, Darren, I mean, they need to have some, they can't, one person cannot do all of that by themselves. And so I say those are the ones that tend to fail the most, is if they don't have enough resources, right? If the person who's originating the deals, negotiating the deals, underwriting the deals, managing the assets is also the same person who's trying to raise the capital and do the back end reporting, it'll never work. It's too much work for, you know, one person to do. You need to have a clear, you need to have a breadth of team or executives or leadership or, you know, people that are executing the strategy that have different skill sets that are doing assigned and doing different tasks, because, you know, nobody's good at everything.
Right. Let me ask you, there's a couple of thoughts in what you're talking about there. You mentioned communication. Is there any kind of a frequency that you find, or is a better frequency for funds to communicate to their investors? Is that a monthly or?
Well, I think quarterly is probably the most common rhythm, and I think if somebody can do a thorough, comprehensive report to the investors on a quarterly basis that gets into both, you know, quantitative and qualitative details about what's happening in the fund, that, you know, that's very, very good. I mean, you may make monthly distributions or put out, you know, brief monthly, you know, statements or something else that people can see, or, you know, you have some rhythm of how investors can communicate. And I'd say, you know, the best ones are always willing to take calls and emails and accommodate their investors, you know, as often as they would like to. But of course, you have to manage your time effectively. You can't, you know, try to do that in a group format as much as possible, so you're not, you know, having one-off calls all day long because you never get anything done. But I, you know, even doing it quarterly in a meaningful way is challenging for many of these people. So the best ones, you know, again, they commit to doing that and they produce the information. You know, one of the things about a 506 rig D fund, and even just a syndication, you know, an individual deal where you have any number of investors inside of one deal, is there's no requirement to have to produce any specific amount of information. It's not like a, you know, publicly traded company that has to produce a quarterly, you know, earnings report, and that's required as part of being, you know, a publicly traded company. I mean, these are private things. There's no requirement to do that. So as a result, it's just all over the map. And if you're an investor and there's no communication coming from the person responsible for your investment, you know, they get nervous, rightfully, because, I mean, everything could be going perfectly well, but if there's no communication around it,
hang on,
depth of that communication, then people just, you know, it makes them uncomfortable. So the best ones make it a habit and a point to devote the resources necessary to producing that information on at least a quarterly basis.
And is that typically in some sort of a conference call kind of format, or?
I'd say a lot of times it's a letter and it's statements, and then oftentimes after the letter goes out, then it's a conference call to answer questions from investors, you know, about that letter and about what's happening in the fund. And I mean, like, I'll use us as an example, right? We produce a quarterly letter. We pay out distributions on a monthly basis, and then we pay out the split of any overage on a quarterly basis, and then we produce at the end of each quarter, once all the underlying investments have been reconciled, we produce a comprehensive letter that explains what's happening in the deal. Sometimes we'll do the conference calls, although I've found that if you do a good job on the letters, then not very many people will even call in because they have the information they need. And then we'll do an annual, we have an annual investor event, and then we have an annual shareholders meeting. So, and then of course, you know, we always encourage people anytime they want to either contact us, set an appointment, come in the office, or here's our phone number and email address, and here's, you know, me as the chief investment officer, and here's our managing director, and here's our portfolio manager, and, you know, call us whenever you want. So that's what we do, and, you know, we try to help people understand. So different people have different capacities to, you know, do all of that. Some do and some don't. A lot don't.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. Well, with a fund, I'm kind of curious, what is the, or is there, you mentioned kind of everything from the flipper all the way up to several million dollars. Is there any kind of an average that you see more often than not as kind of a target for raising funds to get a fund off the ground?
It really depends on the underlying asset strategy. I mean, if the average deal size is, $50,000, you know, that's one thing. If the average deal size is, $20 million, that's a totally different thing. So it depends on the asset strategy. I'd say, for lower end, like fixing and flipping houses, for example, or making loans, and even that will vary by geographic region. I mean, San Francisco's one thing, and, Kansas City, Missouri is another thing, because the average deal size just varies considerably. So it really depends. And then velocity of your assets also matters. I mean, if fix and flip, for example, if your average deal only lasts, 3 months or 6 months, that money comes back in and you can recycle it. You can have a much smaller fund because you're able to redeploy the money because the assets are turning over. But if you're buying commercial property that you intend to hold for 5 or 10 years, you have to raise a lot more capital for that because, to do deals, that money's not coming back in. All that said, usually 5 or 10 million is kind of on the low end. I'd say 20 to 50 is very, very reasonable for many small balance real estate strategies. And sometimes, they're 100 to 500 million. You get up in the 500 million mark and now you're starting to get a little more institutional. But, if you travel in institutional circles, those investors, California State Pension Fund and, Texas Teachers Retirement and that kind of stuff, 500 million is tiny. Strangely, to a lot of non-institutional people, anything below 100 or 200 million is considered very, very small. In our world, 100 or 200 million would be pretty large, and you can have a perfectly good fund making plenty of good money for you and your investors at 15 million, 20 million.
You mentioned some of these larger deals, and obviously, if your strategy is more of a buy and hold, is there a an average, or not an average, is there kind of a longer term strategy that you can say that, like, I mean, what I'm trying to say is if I had capital and I wanted to invest into a fund and the fund had a strategy to buy and hold, what's a long-term hold for these funds?
5 or 10 years, probably. I mean, in a closed-ended fund, you could easily be in that thing for 10 years or more. I mean, and there's open-ended funds, there's closed-ended funds. There are different deals and sponsors that have different time horizons for the individual transactions. So, one thing I love about this business from an investor standpoint is, if you know what you're doing, you know where to look. There are a huge variety of ways or deals that you can put money into that range from, strategy of a year or less to, 8 or 10 years or more, depending on what you're trying to accomplish. But longer term hold stuff, I'd say most of that is probably on the low end, 3 to 5 years. I'd say most funds will have an investment time horizon of 5 to 7 years and then a disposition time horizon of another 2 to 3 years beyond that. So somewhere in that 8 to 10 year range is a pretty typical number for a closed-ended buy and hold type fund.
And at the end of that period, is the fund typically liquidated and then another fund started, or does
a lot of times the second fund would be started once the investment, because usually a typical closed-end fund will have a raise period, so maybe it's 24 months where the manager's going out and getting capital commitments, and then once they've reached a certain minimum level of commitment, 5 or 10 million or whatever it is, then they would start the investment period and they would start acquiring their assets, and that raise period and that investment period would overlap for some period of time. And then as they find the deals and they take them down, they would make capital calls over the course of a 2 year, 3 year period and make investments. And that investment period might last, 2 to 4 years. So between the raise and the investment period, you end up in the, let's call it, 4 year range, at which point the investment period ends and, the fund might end up with 6 or 8 or 10 or 15 assets. Right, and then once the investment period is over, then once those individual assets start being liquidated, and of course each one will be liquidated at a different point depending on what the strategy was for that asset going in. How long is it going to take to get it fixed up, leased up, stabilized, you know, producing the appropriate operating income, you know, and sometimes, hey, if a buyer came along and paid a ridiculous price, the manager may just liquidate it earlier. So usually then there's a preferred return that gets paid to the investor, then their capital gets paid back, and then after that there's some split of any profits above and beyond what that preferred return was. So it's not like, you know, 8 years comes by and then all of a sudden you just go liquidate all the assets at the same time and pay everybody back. You know, that happens sort of sequentially depending on, you know, each of the underlying assets and, you know, what characteristics they have.
The proceeds from the fund then, is that anything that, can be rolled into, you know, via 1031 into another, or is that?
Typically not.
No.
Well, it can be in some cases, but typically funds are treated as LLCs, and they're not. It's difficult to roll them into 1031 exchanges. Those have to be held in either tenant in common or in Delaware statutory trusts, and each of which have, you know, their own pluses and minuses. And so, but I'd say the vast majority of funds do not include the 1031 component.
For the investor with investing capital, these are all accredited investors?
The people that we deal with, yes. I mean, for us, we only deal with accredited and one of the funds qualifieds only, which is a higher threshold than that. There are other structures that are available to non-accredited investors. And some people out there, you know, those namely Reg A, Reg A Plus, or even if they want to do one-off individual transactions, a lot of people can deal with unaccredited investors. So, but I'd say in our practice, anybody setting up a fund, I always encourage them to just do accredited investors only, because that's part of the Reg D requirement.
And is there...
Not exactly that simple. There are some nuances to it, but, you know, that's the gist of it.
Right. No, and is there an average investment level that you see from investors for individuals?
That also varies dramatically depending on, you know, the fund, the strategy, the size. But I'd say the typical minimum in a Reg D fund is either 50 or 100,000. Some are higher. Like, you know, our fund 7 is 250. I've seen funds, you know, with minimums of 500 or even a million. If they're, you know, bigger asset types and they're, of course, targeting, you know, qualified and really high net worth investors and family offices. But there are plenty of funds out there that, you know, the minimum is 50. There's some that are below that. Again, you get into these Reg A deals for unaccredited people, and there's, I mean, with crowdfunding, which is a whole other development here in the last few years, there are, you know, people that are deals that you can get in for as little as, you know, $1,000 or $2,500, $5,000. But mostly in our world, it's 50 or 100 are the two most common, you know, minimum numbers.
The real estate market has its ups, its downs, and, you know, they're both full of opportunities. Do you see, or do you have any kind of a sense of just, you know, the next wave, or any kind of a sense of change with what you guys do? Will it affect any of the funds, or is it just kind of a continue to kind of stay disciplined to your principles?
I see it. I mean, there's just a huge amount of opportunity for what we're doing. I mean, our business is pretty unique. There's just really no one else that has the breadth of what we do. Lots of people do component parts of it, but nobody has put it together in kind of this combination. And so I don't see us, I mean, I see there being opportunity really whether the market is going up or going down. You know, the strategies that people pursue are different, but, you know, there's always opportunity. It's just a different opportunity. So I think we're pretty much, you know, sailing the course that we're sailing, you know, and we may tack one way or the other, you know, depending on how the winds are blowing, but we're fundamentally not going anywhere different.
Is there a kind of a summary here, kind of a one best advice you could give to somebody that was, and I'll ask it two ways. One is for the investor with capital looking to invest in a fund, and then secondly, for the investor that's working to raise capital, that's trying to grow to that next level to, create a fund.
I'd say, you know, do it really thoughtfully. I mean, I think a fund has a certain amount of sex appeal to people. They think they want to do it. It seems sexy, and they want to be a fund manager, but it just really contains a lot of things that may not be right for everybody. So, you know, I think just do your homework. Make sure you're making a good decision, because, I mean, I can't even tell you how many people I've seen sink a whole lot of money into trying to set something up and then having it go nowhere. And, you know, we really try to avoid that with clients. So, you know, it just isn't for everybody. There's, you can run a plenty good business just doing it one deal at a time and go a long way doing that without ever setting up a fund. And that's really a better course for a lot of people. So, you know, I guess my admonition is just be really thoughtful about what you're doing before you jump in.
Makes a lot of sense. Matt, that's kind of the list of questions I had. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't?
No, I mean, you did a pretty good job. I mean, we talked a lot about fund, and, you know, I'm not sure, you know, I travel a lot and talk to a lot of real estate people, and, you know, not everybody's in that position. So hopefully that discussion is, you know, meaningful to some number of people out there, and certainly people that have been running a real estate business for a while and contemplated a fund will get some pretty good insight out of that conversation. But, you know, otherwise there's lots of ways to do well in real estate, and just really depends on kind of what people like to do. And I think maybe the other comment I'd make is that depending on what your objectives are, there are always some way to achieve those. And I think you just got to, you know where to look. So people can certainly check out our site, sbrefunds.com, and we got a lot of good information on there, and obviously happy to take any calls or information people want to get from us. So,
all right, and I'll be sure to list that on the show notes here. And Matt, I want to thank you again for taking the time to do this, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Sounds good, Darren. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, that's all we've got for this week. If you are an investor and you're looking at raising funds, or you have capital and you're interested in investing in a fund, be sure to check out Matt Burke and Fairway America. You can search, or you can also click on the show notes for the link to Fairway America. We know you're busy. We thank you for making time for us today. We do appreciate you. Until next time, thanks for listening to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio.
You're listening to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals. For more information on this or any of our guests, like us on Facebook, CREPN Radio.